It was the spring of 1980 when an unexpected group of musical eccentrics came together to play their first performance at a college party in Athens, Georgia. Within a few short years, they had taken over the musical world with smash records like Out of Time, Automatic for the People, Monster, and Green. REM's distinctive musical flair was unmatched, and a string of mega successes solidified them as generational spokesmen. In the new biography, the name of this band is REM. Peter Ames Carlin takes a look at this group, one of the greatest and what he calls the last American rock band of the millennium. We welcome Peter Ames Carlin to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
What brought you to REM as a subject?
They're such a fantastic band and so influential and you know, and in the early 90s, certainly ubiquitous for a time on radio and on MTV. But, you know, when I set out to find a book to read about them that seemed like it was telling the story that I wanted to hear about them, it didn't seem to be out there. So I thought, well, this is where I come in. I mean, that's generally how I start any book project when I'm trying to write about somebody. And I was just very intrigued by how tied they were to this wave of optimism and political progressivism that sort of rose through the first half of the 90s. I just remember in those days how exciting it was when REM suddenly went from being a kind of cultish band that you know occasionally heard on the radio. They'd had a couple hits in the late 80s, to by the early 90s being like the absolute epicenter of the pop culture. And it was so interesting because they were these obviously intelligent, fairly well-educated, and very ambitious guys who had a really interesting story to tell about alternative cultures and doing things in opposition to what was happening in the overarching mainstream culture.
I mentioned in the introduction that first performance at a college party in Athens, Georgia. What brought them there?
Well, they were in Athens, which is a small college town in the northeast corner of Georgia. Michael Stipe, who was the singer in the band, and the rhythm section, Bill Berry on drums and Mike Mills on bass, were all students at the university. And Peter Buck had dropped out of Emory in Atlanta and moved to Athens to work in the Luxury Record Store. And They were all just kind of indie music fans, essentially, and all played music and were a little bit interested in maybe forming a band to play between their classes or work schedule at, you know, in Athens. And they ended up meeting, they had a mutual friend named Kathleen O'Brien, who knew them all and thought, you know, knew they were all interested in playing music and just thought that they would get along and maybe make some interesting music. And so she introduced them. I think Peter and Michael met at Luxury at the record store, and Bill and Mike had come to the university together because they grew up in Macon, Georgia, and had played in some high school bands together and were very close friends. And so she introduced to both pairs of guys, and sure enough, they did hit it off and started having jam sessions in the back of this church where Peter and Kathleen were living at the time, among a bunch of other students. And it just came together very quickly. And by, you know, the start of the spring, they played their first show at Kathleen's birthday party. And by the end of the spring, they were getting shows at the bars around Athens. And it wasn't very long before they were getting, a first show or two in Atlanta, and then throwing their stuff in the back of a station wagon to drive around to other college towns and start playing, you know, little parties and fraternity parties all around the Southeast.
I use the term in the introduction, eccentric. And I mean, you could make the case, I think, that most artists and musicians are often eccentric. But what was it about their eccentricities that was so interesting, not only for them as a man, but for you as a biographer?
Well, they wrote songs that took basically all the conventions of pop music and turned them inside out or turned them backwards. And just the structures of their songs were always very different from what you would hear on pop radio or from any other band at the time. And the lyrics that Michael Stipe wrote were very elliptical and almost were like riddles that you could only sort of half hear, because in the early days, in the early singles and EP and the first record or two, you know, they mixed the vocals so low with the music. They like to think of the vocal as just another instrument. And Michael, as a writer, was very interested in writing this kind of imagist stuff that was, you know, a little surreal, you know, with colloquialisms and expressions and combinations of words that kind of resonated sort of on an emotional level. But if you ever saw them written down, which you wouldn't coming from the band, because another thing they wouldn't do was print lyric sheets, it was like, you know, what are these, you know, like the literal meaning of the words was in a sense secondary to the sound of them and how, you know, the texture of the words would hit you on an emotional level. And obviously in the early 80s, I mean, really in almost any era of pop music, it was just, you know, a very avant-garde, very surreal way of going about making popular art. And for one reason or another, you know, they worked so hard and the music was so good and they were so distinctive and they were so patient that they spent years building almost hand to hand this following across the country, first in college towns and then in indie populations and all kinds of cities and towns, and gradually, you know, honed their craft until they got to a point where mainstream radio and culture were paying attention to something that was so, you know, in a way, if you described it to anyone, nobody would think it was an acceptable premise for a pop song.
Were all four necessarily on board for the lyrics of a song or understanding clearly what it was about? Did they all have to be all in on it? Or could there just be going along going, okay, well, if that's what you want to do?
Well, in their particular artistic cooperative, I mean, they were all equal contributors. You know, the drummer, Bill Berry, wrote as much music as anyone, really, and was motivational in a lot of ways, you know, and Michael Stipe was, as a lyricist, you know, not only wrote the words, but also wrote the melodies that, you know, that he felt would fit his voice. And he had a very, you know, interesting, obviously super memorable melodic sensibility. And so did they, you know, I think in a way, one thing that was unique about that band was that all four members came in with different influences and slightly different tastes, but also all with the same interest of making very artistic, very interesting music. And so if Bill and Mike and Peter didn't have, you know, a precise intellectual comprehension of what Michael was saying, that was fine, because really neither did Michael, you know. And I think they all were on board with, you know, and very sort of motivated to make music that was on one level puzzling, you know, that was kind of a riddle, and really wanted their audiences to stay with them, and you know, and they wanted an audience that was going to have patience and be able to apply their own imaginations and their own interests into the songs that they were hearing and not have everything just cut and dried and made specific and explicit for them.
And that was fascinating that it found an audience in such a rabid following so quickly, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, in a way, if you were observing them from the Pacific Northwest, say, where I was at the time, or places where they didn't play so often at first, you might think, you know, and you didn't read Rolling Stone magazine or some of the hipper journals of what was going on in pop music, you know, you would almost imagine that, you know, when they began to show up on mainstream radio in the late 80s, that they were like an overnight sensation or something. But they worked really hard. I mean, they hit the road in the summer of 1980 and really worked touring relentlessly for 10 years, essentially, until the end of their Green tour in 1989. So, you know, anywhere you were in 1982, 83, 84, 85, you know, and especially by the middle part of the decade, they were constantly in the van going from club to club or small theater to small theater, slowly growing an audience. And there was a way that they had of nearly doing it, you know, on a personal basis, especially, you know, through the later part of the decade, the last tour or two, they would come into town and immediately go to the university or whatever college was nearby, visit the radio station, hang out with those people, get to know them, invite them to the show. They would meet people after the show and hang out and talk about music or art or whatever interested them and have some beers. And, for years they would go to parties at people's houses after shows, just because they knew that the people who came to their show were just like the friends they had left behind in Athens. They were college age or near to it at the time. And, so it was like coming to a town and meeting their audience was like coming home. In a way, you say, well, deliberate. I mean, not in a cynical commercial sense,
Right.
but they really understood where to find, their people. And the more they met people, the more those people
Yeah.
introduced them to other people, and their audience just grew and grew and grew.
I was at a small college radio station in the mid-80s, and IRS would send out these demo copies of the albums as they were coming out. And I mean, we would always just look forward to them, but I mean, they knew their audience, right? I mean, it was college students, it was young kids, and you couldn't get enough of it.
I mean, especially at the time, I mean, if we look back to the music of the 80s, there was this kind of overarching conformity to it. Music had gotten very sleek, and it was all sort of defined by synthesizers and electronic keyboards of various sorts, and this very sort of shiny, sort of rigid structure that was in some ways enforced by the gatekeepers, not just on popular radio, but on MTV and elsewhere. There was a very kind of sleekness about culture at the time. REM kind of came from the exact opposite field, and essentially being a fan or a follower or an appreciator of their music was like being, in some ways, especially at the beginning, a part of a club. And you could tell something about someone if they were into REM. You'd go to a show, and if you had a particular sensibility, this is where your people were. It was a very much a bonding type of experience. And REM were very much on board with that. And I think one of the reasons why they didn't do that thing of, immediately trying to change their music to fit the standards of radio programmers and other popular gatekeepers was that they knew that anywhere they went, they would be able to find people who were like them, and they would always have an audience. And it was an audience that was going to be loyal and smart and have the patience and interest to let them do exactly the type of music they wanted to do and were going to understand it. And I think that was, for the longest time, that was all they wanted and all they needed. And when they began to become famous in that larger sense, that was at first just sort of, a bonus and fascinating and kind of hilarious, but not exactly necessary.
Because they're hard to even say, like, what was their first big hit? Like, right, that's hard to answer.
Well, the first one that really broke through into the top 10, in terms of Billboard sales and meaning, broad-based play across the country, was The One I Love, which was
Yeah.
on the album Document that came out in 1987.
This one goes out to This one goes out to the one I've left behind. A simple prop to occupy my time. This one goes out to the one I love.
They had a couple radio hits before that that would end up like on AOR radio. So if you were in, LA or New York or a bigger city that had, a slightly more progressive station, you could hear, Fall on Me.
By the sky and tell the sky and tell the sky and tell the sky fall on me.
Or End of the World as We Know It.
Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world.
Or even like earlier, Driver Aid or Radio Free Europe, if you had a college radio station in your town. But But they just had this sort of long, slow ascension through college radio into left of the dial, progressive radio into more mainstream radio, and then suddenly kablammo into the top 10 by, you know, 1987, 1988. And by the time they signed to Warner Brothers Records from the indie label they'd been on in 1988, I think, and that was the year that Green came out, and that suddenly had like an even bigger top 10 single. And then the next album on Warner's Out of Time came out in 1991. And that was explosive, you know, and that launched this, you know, sort of half dozen years where they had like 10 million selling album after 10 million selling album after, you know, mega hit after mega hit after mega hit, sort of leading to this popular apex in 1994 and 95 with the album Monster, and then the, you know, the year-long tour that followed it. What's the frequency, can it the show been so drained?
How did they feel about that? How did they feel going to Warner Brothers and suddenly having this machine behind them?
Well, it was obviously a deliberate move on their part. You know, they didn't have to leave IRS, but I think they felt they got into a position where, you know, if you look back to the very beginning of the band, you could tell that they always had their eyes on a bigger audience. From whatever audience they were playing tonight, they would really like to be playing a bigger audience tomorrow, but not to the extent that they were going to change or, you know, distort their music or their vision. They figured if we work hard and we make cool music and just keep playing and keep it out there, we're going to drag, you know, we're going to bring people in. We're going to capture people's attention. And by the time they got to the end of the decade, I think they felt, you know, they understood that to the extent that they had this kind of alternative vision, not just for music, but for culture as well, they could take this, you know, the values and the ideals of this independent audience that they had and, you know, and capture the mainstream's attention and change people's minds and, you know, and their musical interests and their hearts to some degree with a message that they had, you know, this message of this cool independent stuff that was going on, you know, that you didn't have to conform in this way, that there was another way of living and being and making art. And it was really compelling. It's in a way, it's kind of the same journey that Bruce Springsteen made, you know, in the earlier part of the decade, where, you know, he was very, you know, was very determined to be an artist and to have this kind of alternative political sensibility and sort of working class sensibility he wanted to bring to the mainstream, and sort of made himself accessible and made that message accessible to the point where, you know, Born in the USA is this extremely subversive tale, you know, and it became a top five hit, and that album was a huge smash. And so REM was kind of doing that same thing of taking a message from the fringes of society and getting it into the absolute center of the mainstream and making mainstream society pay attention.
Peter Ames, Carlin is our guest. The name of the new book is The Name of This Band is REM. Bill Berry left the group in 97, but you write in the book that he was starting to grow weary of things early on. I mean, almost a decade earlier, he was tiring of being on the road.
Bill is an interesting paradox. I mean, and a lot of, you know, in any story like this, there's a lot of paradoxical stuff taking place. But Bill was both incredibly, you know, very ambitious and also very knowledgeable of how the music industry worked, because one of the first jobs he had was as an office boy in a booking agency in Macon. And so he got to know exactly how, you know, that part of the industry works, so that when REM, you know, was wanting to make that leap from being a party band in Athens to being a work, you know, professional working band with shows, he had the names and numbers of dozens of people, you know, clubs and the people who ran them, and knew how to call these places, knew what information they needed to get a booking, knew how to go through the ritual of playing shows and going on the road. And he also, as an artist, wrote a lot of the most memorable and commercial, you know, sounding songs in REM's catalog. You know, if you're familiar with Driver 8, you know, that driving music and that riff, that's his. Was important to the writing of a lot of, you know, the big songs like Man on the Moon.
Andy, did you hear about this one? Tell me, are you locked in the pond? Andy, are you goofing on Elvis?
The central chord structure of that was his. The song Everybody Hurts was his composition.
Well, everybody hurts, but sometimes everybody cries. Everybody hurts.
You know, even getting into that final world tour that he played on, I mean, there was some talk in the band of just going back and playing clubs again, even though they were enormously popular. And Bill said, no, we're not going backwards. And, you know, we're at this apex, this commercial peak. Let's play like we're a band at the top of the heap. And so, you know, they had this global tour of playing massive shows in arenas and stadiums and festivals. But at the same time, as much as Bill treasured the idea of getting their music into this huge, you know, the center of the mainstream, he had a very short patience for everything that wasn't music making. He didn't like the travel. He didn't like doing interviews. He didn't like being a public personality. And so as much as he enjoyed his music going into the center of the mainstream, he himself did not want to participate in that process.
Yeah.
And, you know, and stuck with it for, you know, 16, 17 years before he finally figured, I've had enough. And he'd had in that 1995 tour, he had this terrifying thing happen where he, you know, he had an aneurysm burst on stage, you know, and he had to be rushed out of the arena, and within 12 hours or so was having brain surgery. You know, to have this thing repaired. And it was terrifying and potentially fatal. But fortunately, they were in a city in Switzerland that happened to have the most sophisticated brain surgeons on the planet. And so, you know, and so happily, Bill recovered and was actually back on stage 6 weeks later to finish the tour. But that was kind of the end of his appetite to be a global pop star.
I think my favorite song, certainly my favorite REM song, one of my just all-time favorite songs is Night Swimming.
You I thought I knew you, you I cannot judge. You I thought you knew me, this one laughing quietly underneath my breath. Night Swimming.
You write about that, and there's a lot of interest in that. It was fairly as advertised, and yet Michael Stipe was bringing a lot more to it as usual.
Well, Michael, you know, and one of the interesting things about Michael as a person is that he has always been either bisexual or gay, you know, and for the longest time, that was something that he wasn't prepared to talk about in public, you know, through the 80s and into the first half of the 90s, because, you know, as a normal individual, you don't talk to strangers about your romantic life, you know, or your sex life, or what's going on deep inside your, you know, your physical. But the thing is that enough of, you know, there was enough information or enough people understood who Michael was, you know, what his orientation was, that as that, you know, as the band became more popular and the demands of celebrity culture became more profound, you know, the media began to be interested in who is this guy and who's so famous suddenly and making this music and what is he singing about and where does it come from? And so, you know, there was in the first half of the 90s, or when they made the album Automatic for the People, which in many ways is a kind of darker record and has, you know, a handful of songs about death or contemplating death. There's this sense that he, you know, was maybe talking about the AIDS crisis and possibly talking about personally having AIDS, you know, which at the time, of course, wasn't treatable. And so these rumors began, and he fended them off for several years before finally deciding, you know, I could actually do a service for queer people everywhere just by saying, like, not hiding from this and saying, yeah, I am. So what? You know, A, whose business is it? And B, you know, I'm perfectly happy and satisfied being who I am. And he came out of the closet, and, you know, with the release of Monster in 94, and in such, you know, a profound and proud and outrageous way that I, you know, became enormously influential, I think, for gay people in music. And I think throughout, you know, in the celebrity sphere, just because Michael was so out and proud and happy to be who he was in public. And nowadays, you know, it's no big thing for an artist or a celebrity of any sort to say, yeah, I'm gay, or I'm bi, or I'm queer in some way. And to a great degree, you know, there was a threshold that got crossed where that became way more acceptable in pop culture. And Michael was sort of at the headwaters of that.
Obviously, much has been written, and you read about this as well, of course. The way that they went out as far as the breakup, there's the breakup, and then there's just the definitive statement that we are never getting back together again. We're friends. We'll do what we do. We'll see each other every once in a while, but we're never doing this again. I think most, you know, sometimes you're conditioned not to even believe that. And yet in this case, it was like, oh, okay. That seems to track.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, one of the things about REM was that they were always defined by the things that they wouldn't do. You know, in the beginning, they weren't going to make the lyrics accessible. They weren't going to lip sync in their videos. They weren't going to make videos that were anything like what was on MTV. You know, they were going to make what were essentially avant-garde art films, you know, which is what they stuck with for the first half dozen, you know, years of their record making. And so as the years went on and they sort of hit these different levels of music stardom, there were more things that you would expect them to do that they would have absolutely no part of. And as they broke up in 2011 and in this long afterlife of the band, they didn't break up because they were, you know, enraged with each other. There was no alienation, no discontent of a serious type. They've always been great friends. They continue to be great friends. And yet they just sort of felt like, you know what, we had a 3-decade career in which we were way more successful than we ever imagined we could possibly be. So why go back? You know, why, you know, belabor this or go through this long kind of period of just sort of, you know, replaying the hits from the old days if we don't have anything new or interesting to say? And they had felt that they had essentially taken everything out of their particular chemistry that they could. And thus far, you know, 13 years later, except for one very brief appearance where they were being inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame and the four of them played the song Losing My Religion together at the induction ceremony.
That's me in the spotlight, losing my religion, trying to keep up with you, and I don't know if I can do it.
Other than that, they've really stuck with it, and it's not like they don't get huge offers every year. You know, come play Coachella. You know, come play this festival, come play that festival, you know, and launch like a summer long reunion tour of stadiums. And you could come away from that with hundreds of millions of dollars. But it's like, well, you know, we already made that money. You know, we're already doing okay. So if we don't really feel like doing this, if this isn't an art project for us, we're not going to do it. And so far, that's where they stuck. But I, you know, but again, I wouldn't rule anything out, certainly not as a fan. So it's like if they suddenly do a 180 and decide they absolutely do want to get together and make more music and maybe play together again, I'd be all for it. Everything changes. People grow up and people change their mind. those four guys have not shown an inclination to changing their mind about it. But if they change their mind, you know, great, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's a fascinating book about a fascinating band. The name of this band is R.E.M. The book is published by Doubleday. Peter Ames Carlin, thank you very much for being with us. A great thrill to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Again, the name of the book is, the name of this band is R.E.M., a biography. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.